Okay, so this is essentially the fatal flaw I talked about. In evolutionary theory, there's the observable and objective, and then there's all the extrapolation and kind of building out all the assumptions well into, well beyond what can be observed in nature. And so this is the keystone for everything that goes beyond the objective. So, all right. So starting with Darwin's Black Box, which both of these books I commend to you. Michael Behe has some loose affiliation, kind of nominal Roman Catholic, but he will not go full blown creationist. He's an old earth guy, but he has ended up finding himself at odds with most of the scientific community by concluding that variation that we see is designed and had to come about by an intelligence of some sort. All right, so here's his basic thesis. At the molecular level, life is functioning via irreducibly complex machines. These are biochemical machines. Such systems are best explained by intelligent design. So this is the bottom line. So essentially, the concept of irreducible complexity, basically, if any part of these systems is removed or is not functional, the whole system breaks down. So remember, the whole thing that we're looking at today is this question of, can the combination of mutations, random mutations, and selection lead to the diversity of life that we see today? So with that selective kind of context, without a function, if there's a new structure or biological process that takes energy to produce and maintain, would that give an individual any selective advantage to do better in a population? And he would say, yeah, not even close. So he uses, how many of you are familiar with the concept of Rube Goldberg machines? All right. So Behe uses this as an illustration, as sort of a way of kind of introducing the idea of irreducible complexity. So kind of a silly, you know, back scratcher without distracting you while you're speaking to a lady. And this kind of convoluted process that involves a bird and a puppy and all kinds of things. And rainwater filling something up. Basically, if any one of those is misaligned or doesn't work, then it breaks the chain, and you never end up with the final product. So that's kind of a silly illustration, but it's the same concept that we see in biochemical systems. All right, so the example that I'm gonna use out of his book is the one on blood clotting. And I'm not using it because it's the easiest to explain. It applies to all of us, and it highlights irreducible complexity as a concept, but it also is one way to just draw attention to God's amazing design in us. And this would be relevant in all creatures that have blood. So, all right, so basically the problem, you have a closed circulatory system. If it's punctured or damaged in any way, you're going to have the organism is going to bleed to death, internally or externally or both. If we oftentimes can imagine, well, I get cut, the blood starts coming out, and eventually it just sort of dries, and that forms a scab, and then my tissue heals underneath. But it's actually a lot more complicated than that. So if the blood actually clots in the wrong place or at the wrong time, it can actually start impeding blood flow, so blocking circulation. If it doesn't close the cut completely, then it'll just be a slower leak that'll still eventually lead to bleeding out. You can imagine basically anything going wrong, if it's not very, very carefully controlled, you're going to end up with major problems. So just to look at the basics of what starts forming the clot, there's a dissolved compound called fibrinogen. It's a protein that makes up a small percentage of the protein in blood plasma. Another compound that's present, thrombin, basically cleaves the ends of fibrin molecules so that they perfectly stick to each other end to end. And because they stick end to end, it forms long thread-like filaments or threads. That's called fibrin, and they form that. Basically, eventually these threads overlap, crisscross, and start trapping red blood cells, and it starts forming the soft clot. So kind of like a spider web. But if you can see down here in the lower right-hand corner, there's that thrombin activating, cleaving fibrinogen to make fibrin. But it's actually in the context of this huge cascade of biochemicals. And so from the wound surface, I'm not going to try to fully explain which ones are enzymes and proenzymes and all these different activators and regulators. But basically, thrombin does that to fibrinogen to start forming the fibrin and forming the clot. But thrombin normally occurs as prothrombin, which has to be activated by Stewart factor, which has to be activated by something. It's this, if you actually try to unwind this whole process, every single one of these things is present either in the blood or in some cases like tissue factor. It's on the edges of cells that normally don't come into contact with blood. So God has basically designed this where if blood starts showing up where it's not supposed to be, so it's outside of that closed system, it comes in, it immediately starts coming into contact with biochemicals that start some of this cascade that eventually leads to clotting. So this is, it's very, very, very finely tuned so that it only occurs where it's supposed to occur. If you can imagine a blood vessel and these compounds are flowing past an injury site, they have to instantly change state to start acting to form a clot. And anything that changes state that moves on from the injury site, if it continues a clotting cascade downstream of the injury site, you can imagine how that could start causing problems. So very, very complicated. So this is sort of a recap, but basically the cascade, the major components are fibrinogen, prothrombin, Stewart factor, and proaccelerin, but each of those have other activating enzymes and are tightly regulated. These have no function. They're very, very specialized. So they, all of these biochemicals have no other known function outside of clotting. And they occur in the blood or on the inside linings of the blood vessels or in the edges of cells outside of the blood, like that tissue factor that I talked about. So if any single one of these is removed or doesn't function right, the whole cascade basically gets interrupted. And some of it is one does this to this to this to this this, but some of them actually have feedback loops also. If you notice, thrombin goes back up to preconvertin, and you end up like basically almost like the granddaughter regulating grandma to make more granddaughter. I mean, it's this interesting self-regulating, self-accelerating system. So, Mike, were you going to ask a question?
Yeah, so this is an argument for intelligent design.
Absolutely.
So what does the evolutionist say? That he admits that it's irreducibly complex, or does he say it's reducibly complex?
Yeah, I'll have a slide on that. they have to. Remember, this whole thing, people are committed to an ideology. So they'll shift their explanations as soon as something eliminates one operational space for an explanation, then that doesn't mean you question the overall theory. You look for another explanation. So it's like a little piece of broken eggshell under your egg white. All right, so a little bit of a thought experiment of just what would it look like if we had just a slightly simpler version of this system, which is kind of what, you know, kind of reverse engineering that an evolutionist would be trying to do. So if we had basically another one of these compounds, so just if you're missing any of these, and you somehow create this new protein, just comes into being, if it was in an active form, which is the only functional form, it would immediately start a clotting process, and you'd have a runaway clot, if that's it, which would basically immediately kill the individual, which would not help that new capability basically spread within a population. So it would have to come in an inactive form, but none of these can self-activate. So it would also have to be paired with another biochemical that would have to activate it. But that biochemical has to somehow have some kind of triggered release because it also occurs in an inactive form. So all these ingredients are in the mix with each other all the time. Yeah, John?
Also appear randomly.
Yeah, it would have to appear randomly. And these are... It's not just some atom or some, these are not just common generic molecules. These are very, very specialized biochemicals that are produced via an instruction manual in the DNA. So not only would it have to produce the new one, and it'd have to produce it in quantities that would be effective, but it would have to have an inactive form that can be changed to do. So even the shape of the molecules sometimes allows them to flow freely in the blood without thickening the blood or causing clogs. And all the blood has to go through the finest capillaries. So you can't afford like weird shaped molecules just floating in the blood because they'll come in handy when you need clotting. So essentially, if any of these things, if you can even imagine one of these things coming into being randomly, if it didn't do a full function, or if it set in motion some deadly process, it would, going back to this selection model, so evolution doesn't have, as Ethan, I think, pointed out last week, evolution doesn't have a goal. It's blind. It has to just use... kind of be a random process of mutations and then selective pressures that favor some things over another. So if one of these molecules came into being but didn't actually function, there'd be an energy cost to produce a bunch of that, but no benefit, and possibly fatal results. So now the middle was sort of the cascade of clotting. I'm going to start kind of in reverse, the hardening part, the kind of pinkish or mauve-ish color. Fibrin stabilizing factor, that FSF, that takes this kind of soft, net-like, trapped red blood cells and some globby, activated sticky platelets, and actually kind of chemically locks those fibrin filaments together in cross mesh and ends up forming the hard clot. The yellow stuff is basically the regulatory biochemicals that basically normally keep all these clotting factors from just clotting the blood all the time. So I didn't have heparin on here before. None of this is comprehensive. So there's all kinds of, we're just looking, magnifying lens in on the basic clotting factors. But heparin, does anyone recognize that word, heparin? Anyone in medical fields might be familiar with that as an anticoagulant, a blood thinner. So that actually naturally occurs in cells around these areas and is released to activate antithrombin, which basically comes into the process and it ends up inactivating thrombin, which is the main trigger, the final trigger for starting this fibrin forming and forming clots. But it also, it has a broad ability to relock and reinactivate a lot of these different major clotting factors. So each one of the clotting factors has to be activated by its own special little key, but heparin can broadly reset a lot of this system. Not all of it, but a lot of it. So that has important medical uses, but also it's available. We talked about blood flowing through here. Some of these things are basically triggered for release and inactivate and neutralize all these biochemicals as they move, any ones that move past the injury site. Andrew, yes?
So I know if you take calcium carbonate, like Tums, too much, the body stop making its own, and you get heartburn.
Oh, sure.
How would it, could it ever occur that you take too much of an anticoagulant, like for an and then your body stops producing it? Or is there just saying this system is, you know, better and more, would you say, self governing and self regulating than the acid system in your side?
None of this is my field of expertise, so that's a great question. So some of those, a number of things, the feedback loops, you can basically undermine natural production by continuing to basically not stimulate natural production by introducing something externally, and I don't know. This is one that's, heparin is one that is taken more prophylactically, so someone with a known clotting issue, but who doesn't have an acute condition right now. But it's a good question. So once the clot has formed and healing has adequately basically progressed, a series of compounds are basically activated with TPA down here in the blue on the lower left part of that blue, it basically converts plasminogen to plasmin, which is just a very, very aggressive and efficient, basically it chews up all the fibrin, reconverts it back to fibrinogen, and it basically releases all that clotting material, just breaks it, shreds it apart, so that it basically just a recycling program. And TPA is something that medical practitioners have also been able to isolate and give to acute stroke patients or ischemic heart attack patients. So it's basically a super heavy duty clot buster. So anyway, all of those, that's just loosely touching on from a non-expert perspective, this kind of the basics of this clotting cascade, and with the major regulatory mechanisms, and then sort of the dissolution at the end. So again, it doesn't take a ton of imagination to see how the old kind of cartoonish understanding of how clotting works. We just kind of assume it dries up, hardens, and then healing takes place. But there's an incredibly complex system, and you can imagine you're trying to heal in the side of basically a pipe, or if more traumatic injuries, you're going to be severing a bunch of arteries and stuff, and it's going to be more of a mess. But you can imagine, in order for any of this to work, the the blood has to slow down just enough, so through some vasoconstriction, through a little bit of localized gelling from those fibrin molecules forming. But the blood, as the heart is pumping and blood is flowing by, all these biochemicals have to basically switch on basically faster than the blink of an eye and start performing their cascading functions before they flow past the site, the injury site. And the ones that don't hang on and go past have to be instantly switched off. So these biochemical reactions are happening, they're happening lightning fast, back and forth. So it's just really, really incredible. And if you can imagine, this I've kind of outlined a few of the issues, but if the plasminogen was, if TPA was activated plasminogen just a little too early before enough healing had taken place, plasmin would basically be shredding these clots faster or as fast as thrombin and fibrin could form them. So, and there's no overseer. There is, but there's no conscious person on site being like, hey, we need a little more of this. Nope, hold off, we're not ready for you yet. It's all written into the code, so just incredibly, incredibly complex and finely tuned. So kind of one way to get at this question of could these things have evolved with partial functionality? Every single one of those clotting factors that we talked about, if there's a defect in any of those, each one leads to its own kind of version of hemophilia. So if you've heard of hemophiliacs, basically a bleeding disorder, typically until modern medicine was able to start producing some medications to help treat those people, historically, lifespan around 11 years, I mean, you're basically just like trying not to interact with sharp things. It's not an easy way to, it's not a safe way to be in the world. So that, other than extreme examples, that's pre-sexual reproductive maturity. So if that was the case, essentially, could a population even persist? Essentially, you'd just have individuals dying if they started evolving these partial components before they could even reproduce. So you can't have the very individuals that are starting to develop these amazing new biological capabilities be the ones most likely to die before they can reproduce, and then expect these traits to somehow work their way through the whole population. Yeah, Trevor. Yes. Yes.
So it's not like it just
happened. So animalia is a little too broad, but basically your vertebrates are pretty much going to have a pretty. Again, this is not my area of expertise, but this is going to be so even blood composition, like there aren't separate lymphatic systems in some of the arthropods and things like that, but. But yeah, basically, your vertebrates are going to have pretty much this system, and so yeah, you'd have troubles if you had a partial one. So that's with the bleeding. With the clotting, has anyone read Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle? Okay, tough crowd. There's a compound in there called Ice-9, and it basically, if it touches any water, it just, the whole water solidifies and you can't undo it. So it's sort of a, that was what came to my mind when I imagined this, like an unmitigated clotting cascade. So basically that's not a wait around to get your first cut and bleed out and die. That's basically, you just have clots get initiated and your whole body solidifies, and so that's just fatal in infancy. So, All right. So to Mike's question, there's a man named Russell Doolittle. He may still be alive. I'm not sure, but he already has basically several decades of academic career publishing as of the time of the writing of this book. So, and basically, he was the foremost theoretician for trying to explain genetic evolutionary origins of this clotting cascade. And basically, he appealed to this kind of universal yin-yang kind of required balance, like balance just kind of occurs in the universe, maybe because he observed it, not because he could actually explain the mechanisms of it. And he basically described in top-level evolutionary theory journals and just would use words of, like, he'd basically say, well, you know, there are other proteins that are made that are kind of similar. You know, they have some of the same composition. So, you know, basically, just imagine, like, a mutation probably led to a duplication of the DNA that codes to produce these proteins. And so now you've got this extra one. And so you still keep whatever was duplicated and whatever important function it played. But now this new one, it starts taking on these new capabilities, which the protein itself doesn't take on new capabilities. That basically means you have to have the instruction manual to perfectly produce. So the instruction manual that produces these, which if it only does in one cell, in some cell line that mutates, that's just going to be a trace amount in a very one location that's not going to accomplish anything. So it really has to be a capability that originates from mutations that occurred in the egg and sperm of the parents, and now it's represented in all the cell lines that would be relevant to this. And he doesn't explain why a duplication wouldn't just continue making the same exact protein that apparently, theoretically, has been selected for and kind of kept in its box with the original, but somehow this duplication leads to this kind of freedom to, yes, Mike.
So I think of yin-yang as being a stochastic system.
Hmm.
I don't think I'm wrong about that. So the element of time, which we've talked about, I think, in the last several decades, so maybe that didn't occur to Doolittle, there's just not enough time for a stochastic system to make relative order.
Interesting. Yeah, he basically uses terminology that's basically creation terminology. You know, just these things came into being, they appeared, they sprang forth without it, any explanation for the mechanisms that would lead to that. It's a cartoon is what it is. And it passed muster, not because it was actually comparable to the scientific rigor required in a lot of the hard sciences. It passed muster because all the editors of those journals and the readers were by and large dedicated to this ideology. And so he was providing a narrative. So box checked on this tricky, sticky issue. So again, selection and mutation, evolution has no brain, it has no goal, so this all has to be random. So anyway, that's just to try to give a glimpse of one biochemical system in living things that essentially is just incredibly irreducibly complex. And that doesn't even get into, there are all kinds of ups. You can keep going upstream on basically everything we talked about, and I don't have the expert knowledge to do that, nor the time. But the more glimpses you get, the more it's just kind of awe-inspiring. No one can offer an actual rigorous explanation for origins through random mutations and selection. So these are some of the other examples that Behe goes into. And I commend the book to you. He's a good writer, and his explanations for how fast some of these things, some of these biochemical processes have to play out. Think about vision, like new photons going in, and we might think of a man-made machine, which, you know, even a Gatling gun or something that can reset and keep refiring. That's super fast. The resets on vision are way faster than that. So, like picoseconds of resets, which is like a 1/1,000,000,000th of a second or something. I'll go on, but anyway, it's fascinating stuff. But basically, life is just one giant composite of irreducibly complex systems. So you can imagine some things in this cartoonish way developing through, you know, gradualistic processes, but everywhere you turn, you're eventually going to butt up against something that is irreducibly complex. So that's Behe's main thing. So that alone basically makes the extrapolated evolutionary theory impossible through random mutation. Again, selection is a real observable phenomenon. Mutations do exist, like we talked about before. You do have excess population. Not every individual that's produced in a population lives to maturity, and you do have natural variation. But the attempt to explain all diversity of life through that fails many times over from Behe. But now, John Sanford, who is a young Earth creationist and basically an expert in genetics, genetic theory, he actually goes right after the mutation selection question. So his thesis, genomes of all complex organisms. So this would be basically pretty much all of Animalia that he'd be referring to, and plantae and fungi, actually. Basically, most of your multicellular organisms are irreversibly degenerating. So it's going the opposite direction that evolutionists claim, because harmful mutations are arising faster than they can be, faster than beneficial ones. And I put in air quotes because that's sort of a theoretical concept, not a demonstrated one, that even the existence of any mutations being beneficial, and they're accumulating faster than selection can remove them. So I'm gonna just read these little ones. These are just sort of sub points. Essentially, the creation of useful genetic information through mutation selection is impossible. And so these are conclusions. So these are just assertions at this point, and thus cannot explain biodiversity. Genetic degeneration will actually inevitably lead to extinction in thousands rather than millions of years. So basically, what we'll go into, he's basically saying, if you model this basically based on what we observe for mutation accumulation, evolutionary time, deep time, would basically, we'd be extinct by now. So the human race is already in steep decline, and so big picture, the genome had to have been created recently. Not like last week, but recently compared to what most of the scientific consensus believes, and is running down, just like the cosmos and entropy as it's used, like heat death, moving towards heat death in the universe. So we've already talked about this ideology, but Sanford refers to it as the primary axiom for evolutionists. that man is merely the product of random mutations plus natural selection. So this mutation selection marriage being the sort of generator of and author of all these things. So it's basically universally taught pretty much in academia. Even at many Christian colleges, you can still end up with science teachers that basically hold to this. It's a huge hurdle for anyone to even consider a question because it's enforced. It's an enforced ideology. Good luck getting tenure if you start questioning this stuff as an academic. The gatekeepers in the academic journals basically will filter. You can get not only a rejection on a paper that actually threatens any of this, but if you're known, if your reputation gets in front of you for talking about this stuff, even other papers that are not controversial will oftentimes get filtered out from journals. So, and then just the idea that ideas have consequences. People going to college, not being prepared for this, walking away from their faith because they think, well, I guess what I believed wasn't true. This is all random. And then just the idea of a lot of the self-destructive behaviors that we see in society, if you just think you're basically the product of random goo. So Sanford distinguishes between, so we talked about variation being one of the pillars of evolutionary theory. He distinguishes between designed variation and the kinds of variation that come about via random mutations. And he uses this as an illustration, which I think was really clever. All these car parts, which you have different kinds of rotors for different kinds of vehicles, different kinds of belts, filters, all this kind of stuff, but they're perfectly designed for their specialized functions. They're clean, they're the right shape, they're consistent, compared to rust, dents, scratches. These are the kinds of accumulated things you get through mutations. That's the kind of variation you get. Well, I've got a unique dent or scratch. What does that do for me? And eventually, the tiny, tiny little, like atom by atom, oxidized little bits of steel that start rusting away, you can't, eventually, that just, you know, basically affects the entire apparatus. And it doesn't lead to, rust doesn't lead to new beautiful car parts, so. All right, so this is a little bit of a disturbing one, but it is important. Basically, go ahead, Ethan. Sure. What's that? Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So we'll get into an example in just a couple slides of the kinds of, so the algorithms are designed, they're tested by engineers with intelligence. And if they're not performing well, if they're not beneficial, they'll be modified. There are no engineers. There's no allowance for an intelligence to be at work in this context. So I'll get to the basically a jet like kind of instructions kind of example to just illustrate some of that in just a second. But it is a good question though. So in an individual there's maturation to basically adulthood, but throughout as soon as we become a fertilized egg, every cellular division in each cell, at every division, we accumulate a handful of new mutations. There are a few copy errors at every single division from the very beginning until we die. Across an order of decades, that starts adding up to thousands or tens of thousands of mutations. And basically, what we think of as aging, once we've reached adulthood, though the mutations are accumulating even through childhood, it is largely the effect of, like, old age is basically the cumulative effect of every single one of our cells in our body basically accumulating mutations and building upon themselves, those mutations building up in every single cell line in our body until we die. And essentially, we essentially rust out as, it's basically genetic entropy at the personal level. And essentially that has, you know, we've probably heard things like, we're a completely new person every 7 years or something like that. You know, everything has been replaced, but in some, I don't know how true that is. Some cells in our body are replacing, I don't know, someone here probably knows better than me, but maybe every few days or something. So some are faster or longer than others, and that can be stimulated by different factors. But essentially, our cells have way more generations in a long-lived human than we've had generations of humans. So if you think about, like, on the personal level, it's crude, and it would be much more than this. But if you imagine, like, the second hand of a clock is like the accumulated mutations and entropy on the individual level, and the hour hand of the clock is sort of the every tick of a new generation. Essentially, this gives us a preview for what's happening in the gradual degradation of every time an egg is fertilized. That's another division with its own set of new mutations that are built on what's come before. So we can observe it on this kind of rapid scale, and it gives a preview of essentially what's happening to the human genome large scale. So I guess, Ethan, this is an example from the book, but he basically gives some kind of just an imaginative little exercise of you could have a copy error for this little snippet of instructions. Some of this has to do with time, some, you know, repeating of steps or order of operation, some of it's material thickness. But just imagine swapping out one of these letters anywhere. Essentially, some things would, you could still follow the instructions, they'd still be clear. But some of them, if you change, you know, it would have a major effect. Like the ones that are underlined, if you changed 10 millimeters to 80 millimeters or probably even 15 millimeters if it's that important to have, you know, 4/1000ths of a millimeter, you could imagine that totally messing things up. So if, with no direction, no intelligence, could you just have these repeating errors accumulating and lead to new jet technology or new patentable, you know, parts or processes? It wouldn't work. So then another concept is, and I'm going to try to start speeding things up. This is an old Latin kind of puzzle that someone made where it doesn't matter what it means. There are no bad words. But this Sator Arepo Tenet Opera Rotas, if you look, you can start the same thing from top to bottom, bottom to top, left to right, right to left. So you could, I don't know Latin words very much, but you could imagine where you could swap out a letter on one of these, and you could still have a word that means something there, but because it's it has meaning in multiple directions, it becomes much less likely that you're going to have a retention, you're not going to have a degradation of meaning in a second direction. And once you start getting three and four, it basically becomes mathematically absurd to imagine that you're not degrading information. And as we learn more about how DNA functions, some gene sequences code for one thing in one direction, but they also are read the opposite direction. Some perform functions in how they fold. Some code for things in a nonlinear fashion. And a lot of this is, basically our DNA is not a square box, but it's this concept of it's polyconstrained. So you can imagine theoretically a beneficial mutation copy error that still means something in one direction, but you're simultaneously losing information in other directions. And then I'm not going to go very much into this, but some of you are probably more familiar with me than me on information theory, but just this concept that in spite of our denial of get God out of the picture ideologically, information, DNA is an information system. It's an incredible, it's the most complicated one in existence. Information can only be created by an intelligence, and it can only be maintained by an intelligence. So that's just an important point. And in Hebrews 1:3, we read, he upholds the universe by the word of his power. And just thinking about who's the word is Christ. And the word was in the beginning with God, the word was God, and all things that were created through him. And now he also upholds. So that's that's the author. This is basically the point here is junk DNA. If you have, people used to think most of DNA was junk, and so we only had a small percentage that was actually coding for things, and that sort of gives you a tool shed where you can have things being built, but they don't have to work right away, even though that actually doesn't work because if they're not doing anything, they also can't be selected for or against. But basically we're learning there's very little of the genome is junk. As I'm running a little bit low on time, basically the concept here by Kimura back in the mid-1900s basically built out some really good models that no one's really been able to dispute in their theory, but he is basically saying all these mutations they're almost all deleterious. Sanford basically wrote in this little tiny niblet of beneficial mutations. He basically said, I'm being super generous here, just to make it visible. But in a genome of 6 billion base pairs, a couple hundred mutations are going to have a vanishingly small effect unless they're major mutations. And so most are going to be near neutral. And then basically, if you factor in, I'll get to that. If you factor in noise, like just random chance, random luck, if you're a giant, you know, thousands of sardines in a bait ball, is it your genetic superiority that's going to be the reason you ended up not getting eaten by seabirds and dolphins and a whale shark? Or is it going to be kind of luck? So basically you have this zone outside of here. There are no significant beneficial mutations. Everyone agrees on that, even the most dedicated ideologues. But there are minor but significant and major mutations that will basically be visible because they're a big deal, and those will be selected against. So that helps regulate the system to prevent rapid degeneration, but selection is basically blind to this. A review of Kimura's work that I just read part of just recently by Kern and Hahn in 2007, they basically said, Kimura made great contributions, but ultimately it hasn't aged well. He was wrong. Why was he wrong? because this neutral zone, like Kimura basically said, this is the only place, this is where most of the mutations are, and anything that could be neutral, remotely neutral, or beneficial is in this, is invisible to selection. So that's basically where evolution had to be. You know, new traits had to come out of this neutral zone or near neutral zone, because selection can't see it, it's invisible. And they basically said, Kimura had to be wrong because it doesn't have enough explanatory power for the diversity that we see today. It just can't do it. So Kimura basically said, it can't be happening out there. That can't be where new information is generated. It has to be where most of these mutations, the vast majority of these mutations are occurring. And these guys are saying, well, it can't be here because selection can't even see it. So we have to come up with a new way. He's wrong, but we can't actually explain away his theory. There just has to be an alternative. And so they basically don't really have an alternative. So they basically just scratched out the only zone that was left to them. And then with noise, random variation and stuff, it basically just expands the theoretical no selection zone. Yeah, Tony. Yeah.
Do you see, or do you anticipate a breaking of the dam, a stronghold that academia has on the theory? Like, is that moving in the direction of, okay, people are actually starting to question this?
It's a good question. So I think there are a couple things. One is people suppress the truth. Like, we're in a spiritual battle. People worship the creation rather than the creator. Like, we're going to have that phenomenon until Christ comes again. That said, we do have most of the people educated in these areas. They're not really educated in these areas. To some degree, they might take offense at that. I'm sure they would take offense at that. They're basically indoctrinated with the ideology, and then they're given the cartoons to frame it out. By and large, the evolutionary theorists are way ahead of the general scientific community. But they're ideologically committed, and so, with very rare exceptions, they just keep shifting their position. So, if it was merely intellectual and it was just a matter of figuring out what are the facts. And if all humans were basically rational creatures who just were nothing but intellectually honest and consistent at all times, then yeah, I think we would probably already be there. But we're not, obviously, and that affects all of us. I mean, it's just that our nature is we're not just rational creatures. So. But part of it is, I think, that it's not really, a lot of this information isn't really, people aren't being exposed to it within the scientific community. So the stuff that is inconvenient, it's a very small percentage of people that are actually looking at some of the inconvenient truths. So, but I think it is important, and I think these things are helpful actually countering some of these ideas. Part of it is to protect ourselves and our children. Part of it is to engage with people who are lost. And because a lot of this, it isn't ultimately about the science. It's about acknowledgement of God's existence and authority and sovereignty. I'm running low on time, so I am going to. Basically, conservatively, if conservatively, this is all stuff that's published. The author uses 100 mutations per generation accumulated from our parents. that's on top of everything that every generation before us had. It might have been, I can imagine that it was a lot, like even the rate of mutations, the rate of copy errors, you can imagine it being slower post-Adam, you know, closer post-Adam and faster now. But if there are 8 billion people on the planet as a population, that's 800 billion new mutations inherited in one cohort of humans. If you try to, you have to have excess population for selection to act upon something. So imagine 2 billion humans are selected out of the population, can't reproduce, die, something. You still end up with 600 billion new mutations just in one generation, and that's conservative. And the vast majority of those are deleterious. And if you even try to argue that two-thirds of them are perfectly neutral, that still leaves 200 billion deleterious mutations in one generation. Yeah, John.
With that many mutations constantly going on, population spread throughout the world, mm-hmm. we should be seeing an increase in mutation in different people throughout the world, so much so that we can see differences in people from China to the United States drastically different. In
Yeah, so part of that is, remember, there's designed variation. And then there's the variation due to just gradual degradation. So you know, think I'm running out. We'll talk later. Basically, for sure, if some mutations are gonna be retained in some populations differently than others, and that. Anyway, I need to wrap this up because I want to respect Sunday school teachers. So some of these fast reproducing organisms can much more efficiently select out each individual cell, and they produce gazillions of, they're basically the opposite life history of us. They can mass produce, you know, bacteria and stuff like that. And they can, every single cell can be filtered out if it starts having problems, compared, and much shorter genome, much less, smaller target for mutations. So basically this phenomenon, he works out the theory in the book, but it affects more multicellular and much more complicated organisms much, much faster. I'm gonna move on. So basically his conclusion, the extinction of the human genome in a much shorter time frame than sort of evolutionary time, as it's referred to, is a certainty. It's unavoidable. Again, I commend the book to you. He fleshes out the different angles and the different arguments that have been kind of brought up to try to address this. But every time it ends up basically reintroducing unrealistic scenarios. Yeah, John. Yes, I think it's extremely compelling. So yeah, this is his conclusion, and I believe it's absolutely true. He basically says thousands of years, but it's interesting the decay curve. He actually charts out biblical ages and time, and it follows it's steep at the front, and then it starts flattening out, and it's hard, you know, it's limited data points, I'll talk about this next week a little bit. I'll just plan to touch on this a little bit next week since we're out of time, this shouldn't be something that we need to be concerned about in the same way we shouldn't need to be concerned about our sun, you know, burning out. He will provide, you know, God will sustain us exactly according to his plan. This isn't something where we're on a, essentially the curve doesn't do this, and we're right here, and we're like three generations from smacking the bottom of the cliff or something. It is still very gradual, and natural selection actually works to clean up the stuff that would steepen the curve. So, but it doesn't go back up. It essentially can't go back up. So this is my attempt to kind of have a crumbled arch. But essentially, mutations and selection cannot account for the actual complex, irreducibly complex systems. They cannot. One of the things. Last point. Mutations are. Our genes don't get passed on like total break apart all the puzzle pieces. They don't get passed on base pair by base pair. They get passed on as these, you know, tens of thousands to millions of base pairs long linkage blocks. And so if you get a vanishingly rare beneficial mutation in one of those linkage blocks, the rest of the block has been gradually accumulating. If it's gotten any mutations, their odds favor by like in the order of millions to one that all those mutations are just deleterious. And so to keep the rare beneficial one in that block that it's in, you have to keep everything else that's in there, which means the bad ones too. And it's this concept called Muller's ratchet, and it's basically one of the problems in evolutionary theory where they're like, how do we clean those out? You can't. There's no mechanism for it. Selection can't do it. Genetic recombination can't do it. Artificial selection can't do it. So basically, the theoretical parts, the extrapolated conclusions that are really driven from ideological presuppositions more than actual, especially the more we learn rigorous science, it doesn't work. So anyway, I'll stop there. Sam, would you please close us in prayer real quick?